We're back with Colonel John McManus at his home, interviewed by Kaylin Ayers, and we're going again. Were you part of HOTEF when the helicopters for the Persian Gulf were converted?
Yes, I was. In my first tour at HOTEF, I had just come back from the Bredor Lakes. We had taken the HAPS, the Helicopter Acoustic Processing System, the dry end, the wet end, the reeling machine. We had it on a research vessel called CFAV Quest. And while I was there, the decision was made to send Canadian resources to the Gulf. And we were just in the process coming back from the Bredor Lakes, and I landed back, and all of a sudden my priorities shifted on that day, because while we were looking at the acoustic processing system that was bid for the NSA, that became very secondary to the fact that in about 3 weeks these Canadian ships and aircraft were going to sail for the Gulf on a completely different role than what they had done before. So in Halifax Harbor, there was all sorts of excitement going on modifying the ships for the new roles. Over on the Shearwater side, we formed what they call the Combined Test Force. And it was combined of essentially three different organizations. The NDHQ team combined with contractors that would buy this equipment, decide what equipment to buy, work with the contractor. So there was a representative of all the different contractors there and the actual staff officers from NDHQ. So they brought them to Shearwater. Then there was HOTEF, and they took us as a complete cell, all 18 of us, just because that was our line of work, was evaluating stuff and testing it in aircraft operationally. And then they brought in the guys from AT, which is the Aerospace Test and Evaluation organization out of Cold Lake, and they do flight tests and eval. In other words, they evaluate. They don't worry about the operational ability. They worry about what's safe to fly. In other words, when you hang stuff on the side of an aircraft, is that aerodynamically fit? What does it do to the flying characteristics? What do you have to do to your checklist to modify to make sure that this new equipment will not, cause you to crash? So typically, when you're putting stuff in an aircraft, it's a linear process. So the guys in NDHQ work with the contractors, and they get to a certain point, and they say, yeah, that's good to go. Then the guys from AT get a hold of it, and they evaluate it, and they say, I don't like this, I don't like this, and they go back. And then eventually they say, okay, this is fit to go. Then the guys from AT would give it to us, and they would say, okay, evaluate it to see if it's operationally effective. And there would always be cases where we would say, no, you put this thing on here, and I know why you put it on here, but that makes it very awkward for the operator to use. Perhaps you could put it on here. And then we would have to send it back, and AT would say, oh, yeah, well, we're going to have to test fly that again. So the great men that put this whole thing together, which I mean was quite a masterful idea, was throw them all in one room. And they can be in different corners of the room. And what we'll do is we'll break this process up into, as opposed to everybody having their own little job, all these new things that we're going to put on the aircraft, we'll have cells of people that are responsible for each characteristic of the operational capability that we want to get. And so, for example, I had two pieces of equipment that I was working with, and I had guys from AT that I worked with, and I had contractors and NDHQ. And my personal job was the forward-looking infrared, the FLIR, and the GPS. So those were the two pieces that, the great men decided, okay, Captain McManus, you are in charge of the operational test and evaluation of those two things. And I'm sure, I don't know if you're aware of all the things, we put about 10 new things in the aircraft. And some of them I didn't really, know all, because what we did is we had different aircraft that we were modifying, but we modified them all with their own pieces of equipment independently, and then put the whole process through until we had our little thing together, and then eventually the aircraft that we'd modified then started receiving the equipment that the other guys had done, you see. So my line of work was forward-looking infrared, which I had never seen before. I'd never seen a FLIR before. And GPS. And I had seen a GPS before, but I had never really operated one, and I'd never... I'd never thought about... where does the antenna go on an aircraft? Where does the display go? Then how do you use this operationally? And the reason why GPS was important was when you went into the Gulf, there's all sorts of conflicting border disputes going on, and there's areas where, you know, Iraq had said that's our water, Iran says that's our water, Oman says that's our water, and the crews are given these very good maps and stuff, but unless you can actually say, I know I'm exactly there, you are in danger of violating someone's territorial waters. And at that period, especially while Iraq was physically inside Kuwait, I mean, there's a shooting war going on, so you don't want to inadvertently go in the wrong place. That's why we had to put GPS in the aircraft. Forward-looking infrared gave us a whole new capability, a night capability that our aircraft never had. Because if we were going out, for example, on a search at night, we didn't really have much. We had our radar, but if you're looking for a body in the water, or if you're looking for something that's going to show up, you know, your pilots are looking out the front of the aircraft, but if it's dark, you're not going to see anything. All of a sudden, when we put in forward-looking infrared, night was our day. And I remember, even on my first flight, we had to design the mount. I mean, I didn't actually design the mount, but the mechanical engineers that were said, okay, where do you want this on the aircraft? Well, we said, you know, operationally, we want it right on the front, right on the nose, which is where it is now. And the mount that we designed was very rudimentary with some angle iron. I mean, just, it was just like a square set of angle iron hooked onto the front of the aircraft. And then we had to figure out, okay, where are we going to run the wires to? Where are we going to put the display? Like, we got the, you know, I explained to you with the navigator and the sensor operator, there's no place. This comes with a 12-inch CRT. Where does it go? So right away we said, well, the sonar's got to go. Because, like, if we're not taken, we looked at the geography of the Gulf and said, there's no point taking the active dipping sonar. There's no submarines there. So, okay, so now we got some real estate. Let's put this forward-looking infrared where the sonar was. And the sonar operator, which was his primary job will now be the FLIR operator, FLIR and radar. So we fundamentally changed how the aircraft was going to operate. But on my first flight, after we got the angle iron on, we got our first one on, when we leave to go to our operational area where we used to go flying, we used to go by the Imperial Oil Refinery. And there was a Texaco refinery on one side of Shearwater and the Imperial Oil Refinery on the other. And I remember looking at all the pipes and looking at, for example, the oil tanks, and you could see the level of oil in the tank because there's a temperature gradient. So like where the oil is, you could see, like, you look at this big tank, normally you'd never know how much oil is in there, but when you look at it with a forward looking infrared, you can see, it just looks like you're looking at that water bottle right there. And you say, okay, that's how much water is in there. And if we looked at that with a FLIR, you'd see that same thing, because my water's cold and my air would be warmer and it would show up just like clear as day. And we went by, on our return leg, we went by the Texaco refinery. Now, what's really funny about this was, Texaco was having financial problems at the time. And the government of Nova Scotia had poured a bunch of money into that refinery. And Texaco kept saying, oh, well, you know, it's doing okay. Well, when we flew by with the FLIR, all the pipes were cold. There was no oil in the tanks. And we went, holy smokes. All of a sudden, this thing is of intelligence value. And even to fast forward a few years ago, North Saanich, Sydney RCMP were doing a bust on a grow-op. And they called me up when I was CO of 443 and said, understand your FLIR could look at a house and tell us whether it's hot or not. I said, yeah, yeah, we could do that. If I look at a grow-op house, I would know right away. He says, okay, can you, you know, launch your aircraft and come and have a look? Here's the address of a house and we need you to have a look. And I said, no, I can't do that. As a Canadian Forces, we cannot spy on Canadians. And no, you can ask through the Department of National Defense and request for me to do that. But I can tell you right now, we won't be allowed to do that because we can't look at, you know, people's houses and tell you whether they're hot or not. But it was very interesting because all of a sudden we put this thing on an aircraft, and then as the aircraft, we all of a sudden had huge increase in ability to know what's going on out there, both day and night. Like normally everybody thinks forward-looking infrared, it's for night. Well, you learn lots of stuff in day too, from temperatures of things, not to mention looking for somebody in the water if there was a, or so, looking for somebody in the woods or whatever. Those are all applications. But the main application was, we realized that none of the other helicopters in the Gulf had night FLIR capability. The Americans were in the process of getting that. But when those aircraft got to the Gulf, the crews all thanked me later. They said, you know, McManus, one of the benefits to having this really good FLIR on our radar or on our aircraft when nobody else here has it is what times do you think we had to fly? You know, from 10 at night until 3 in the morning. And we got that every night. Like I say, he said, well, the Canadians have this capability and it's all quite operationally effective. I said, okay, well, you're welcome. Why? So like, we gave you that capability. It was something that we never had before. So my little line of work was GPS and FLIR. And yet what we did is we kind of fit into the great big scheme of things. And then we had to create a checklist for this aircraft, which we at HOTAF did. Is how do you start this aircraft up? What equipment can be on? When can you turn the equipment on? How do you use it? And then we had to create what we call an SMG, our standard maneuvering guide, which is how do you use this operationally? And we didn't really know because like we'd never seen it before, but we had a better shot at it than anybody else. So what we did is we sent these guys off to sea, and we actually sent some of our HOTAF guys as they went across the pond from Halifax to, they were going to the Med, so, and then through the Suez Canal to get to the Gulf. And we sent some of our HOTAF guys on board, not me, but some of the other guys, to actually, each time the crews would come down, they would get feedback. And the guy said, you know, your checklist, it's out of order here, because when we do this other piece of equipment that we're using, it wants to be doing this at the same time, and it, you know, it doesn't work. And so then our HOTAF guys would say, okay, yeah, let's make a recommendation on changing the order on the checklist or whatever. So then our guys would have to kind of be the overseers of the tactics, because we had put on flares, which is for, you know, evading heat-seeking missiles, chaff, which is for evading radar-seeking missiles, an RWR, radar warning receiver, which is almost like what you'd have on a car for detecting, you know, radar traps on it, you know, up front. And we also had a MAWS, which was a missile attack warning system. And the MAWS was a system where it detects the plume of a missile coming at you. Because if you have a heat-seeking missile, you don't have it, like, it's not like a radar-guided missile. Where a radar-guided missile is kind of like the sonar that I told you where it's coming out. Well, the radar-guided missile takes a shot, gets a radar fix on you, and says, okay, I'm going after you. And that's why what you do is you drop off the chaff. Hopefully it sees the chaff way more than you, and then you do an evasive maneuver. Well, with the MAWS, the missile attack warning system, it detects the plume of heat coming out of a missile. So we put four sensors, two front, two back, so that they all cover essentially a 90-degree quadrant. And they're looking out all the time. Well, one of the things that we didn't know is, do you set this up on auto or do you set it up on manual? In other words, do you tell the crews, okay, here's the MAWS, you know, the MAWS, the one that we bought for them in 1990, it was very bad at false detections. And so what would happen is, you know, your own ship would light something up. The MOS goes, oh my God, there's a missile coming at us. And if you have it set up in automatic mode, it'll fire off your flares and turn night into day, which is not a good thing for a couple of reasons. One is, where are you when this happens? And second of all your flares, it shoots them out in order so that eventually, see, the missile gets sucked up on those flares and then it doesn't attack the heat of your engines, because a heat-seeking missile attacks the hottest thing that it sees. On a seeking or on any aircraft, it's the engine, so it comes after your engines. But the great men that designed these flares designed them so that the gate of the missile looks at that, they said, that's hot, I'm going to chase that. And essentially, if you look at these missiles when they've done tests, they go from flare to flare to flare, and then hopefully once you've stopped shooting the flares and you've gone somewhere else, the missile's going at, you know, Mach 0.9 or something, and it can't make that hard corner to catch you. But what you need to do, what we as HOTEF have needed to do, is first of all, we got to teach these guys how to use the gear. And second of all, then we got to combine that with tactics in the aircraft. So, okay, here's the scenario. You just got shot at with a missile. Your MOS detected it. You want an automatic or manual? Well, that's a whole other discussion. And then if you have it in manual and you hit the button and say, okay, fire my flares, then what do? And we had several guys that just about put the aircraft in the water, you know, when they had false detections on the MOS, because they got so scared. They just, you know, push the nose forward, dump the collective, do the hard turn, and it was, you know, it was some false alarm. But we had to come up with tactics, and it was very difficult for us because it was all new stuff. All these things that we put in was all new. And then, if you think about it, we're sending this crew of four into a hot area with all this new equipment, and said, okay, boys, good luck, have fun.
When all the new electronic equipment, the MOS and whatnot, when it was in manual, who had control of that? Was it TACO, ASO?
The different people had. It was mainly the MOS was mounted at the TACO station, so it would be the TACO that would decide whether it's in manual or automatic. For the actual release of the flares, it was the pilot that would release the flares or the chaff. So it was hooked onto the stick. So they would release it. But I don't even remember. This is many years ago, so I don't even remember. I think our resolution, we decided not to use the MOS at that time in automatic mode. I mean, things may have changed now, and it's many generations later, but the problems associated with false alarms were just too great at that time. And the pilot would have control, because the pilot was the guy that would have to dump the flat, the in both cases, chaff and flares, and then take evasive maneuvers. So TACO's not going to be doing that.
You were also given a door-mounted gun?
Yes. Yeah. I didn't remember all the stuff. Yeah. We had which was a very interesting thing, because as a Sea King, we had never fired armament out of the physical thing. So yeah, we and that was a difficult thing to do, because it had to be rugged enough to stay there, but then it had to get out of the way because it was in our door at the back, where we do hoisting and slinging and taking gear in and out of the aircraft. So we had to have a mount. And the other thing it had to do, it had to not be able to shoot our own rotors off, because when we put it in automatic mode, you had to put stops on it so that it wouldn't, because when you're actually flying along in the Sea King, and you have to figure out what's the max deflection of the rotor and not let the gun shoot past that. And you also don't want to be able to shoot your tail rotor off. So you have to put all these limits on, and then you got to put it on a bracket, and then you got to train guys how to use it. And I was actually on involved on the first flight where, because one of my other, one of the other guys was a project officer for the gun. And he took me flying with him when he was an ASOP. Because it was a job that was going to be done by the ASOP, while the navigator's looking after all the tactics and stuff. So the ASOP, you figure, okay, if he's not doing the floor, well, he's going to be back manning the gun. So this ASOP was the project officer for this. And so he took me with him because he had to have a navigator on the flight. So then we both got back and went to shut. So we set up a bunch of buoys because we had to figure out what's the range of this gun. So we put some Javex bottles, and we did, like, we put one at the where we were going to shoot from, and then we will put one at 100 meters, 200 meters, 300 meters, 400 meters, 500 meters, out to 800 meters to see what our range of our gun was, because we had no idea what this gun was going to do firing out of an aircraft. And also firing on different modes where you fire bursts and two or three shots at a time, and then we had tracer ammunition, and so we had all these different kinds of ammunition. And the funny thing was, it was very accurate in this mount. It was much more accurate than if you took a gun and like shot at the rifle range. When it was in the mount, and you could, especially with the tracer in it, you could bring it right on to whatever you were shooting at. It would take a burst of maybe 10 or 12, and then you could hit it. But what I found interesting, and it was a very small caliber machine gun, it was C7. I don't even know what caliber it is, but very small. And what I remember when we did this first evaluation is we could put it onto the bleach bottle, but the bullets didn't even pierce the bleach bottle; they just bounced off. I mean, it wasn't. But I'll tell you, it looked impressive. It looked like when you had this gun hanging out the back of an aircraft. And in fact, the first time that it was used was a young female ASOP from 423 Squadron, and they were enforcing a certain area of no-go for these dhows in the Middle East. And I think it was in the NAG, the Northern Arabian Gulf, where they were. And they had orders to not let these dhows go, and then they called them up on the radios, and they just ignored them and the ship. They ignored the ship, they ignored the aircraft, and the aircraft was like, you know, and the first shots that were fired in anger from a Canadian Forces aircraft since either Korea or World War II, I don't remember which one, but was fired by the female ASOP because she got told, put a line of tracer across their bow. And don't shoot at them, but just sit in the hover and put a tracer across the bow and say, turn around. And as soon as she did that, they all turned around. But it was very interesting because, at that time, Canada had deployed the F-18s, and the boys were all, you know, scratching their chest, talking about how, you know, the war fighters are here. And the first shots fired in anger were from a female ASOP on that gun. And I'll tell you, especially in the evening or night, the tracer, because every third round, I think, had a flare in it. It looked very impressive. You know, people just respected the fact. They thought, well, if you're going to have a gun hanging out at the back of a helicopter, it's probably pretty good. But it was very, if a guy had a heavy raincoat on, I think it would have bounced off him.
Yeah. So because it was out the back, in order to engage, you would have to hit it into the hover and...
Correct.
Essentially?
Correct. And it's essentially what you would have to do. The pilots and then the navigator would have to put you in such a place so that the right side of the aircraft was there. And the pilots would have to maintain that configuration. So there was total communication between the ASOP who's firing the gun, you know, but the pilots would know it has to be out. It's kind of different than normally... You would think, you know, you're going to shoot ahead, but in this case, you're shooting 90 degrees out your right hand side. So yeah, that's like the geometry of the gun.
With all the upgrades given during the Persian Gulf upgrades, did they work better on a tactical heads-up display for the pilots, like the communication between back and front, or did it stay rather rudimentary?
Rudimentary. That's probably the limiting factor of this whole aircraft. Is even, for example, the GPS, which is mounted at the navigator station, the pilots don't see the GPS. So they only have the information that the navigator gives them, and then that fly-to needle. So, for example, it's not certified to do a GPS approach somewhere because the pilots don't actually have the ability to fly on the GPS. It's a secondary thing that essentially what we can do. Not during the Gulf War, but following the Gulf War, when I was at HOTEF, my second tour, in the mid-90s, we got the Garmin to put out once a second, digitally, its position, and then we got the software to take that into our nav system, so that the navigator's nav system, instead of being just a rudimentary plot that, you know, best guess on where you were, it was every second it was updated by the GPS. So as a navigator, then we knew exactly where we were. And if we knew where we were going, then we could put the needle on and the pilots would fly that needle. So they could essentially fly a GPS approach, but it's not a legal GPS approach because there's intermediary stages in there. In that, let's just say me as a navigator, I put the wrong point in that fly to point. Well, the pilot could have the world's greatest GPS approach into the wrong place, and he would never know because all he sees is a needle that he's following. So all of that information that flows, whether it's information that's on the MOS, information that's on the forward-looking infrared or the radar or anything, is all just communicated by mouth to the front of the aircraft. Like, that's, of course, going to change in our new aircraft, but that was the limiting factor.
Do you know when, say, the British and the Americans started to do better, like, tactical heads-up displays like that? Like, that communication between front and back?
Yeah, well, because the British did it when they transitioned to their EH-101. Because when we were down in AUTEC in 1995, they had their first EH-101 on the test range. So that was when they started to do their transition. And the Americans did it when they went from the Sea King to the Seahawk. In the mid to late 80s, so that's when they did their transition. So because it was just a matter of getting that all that information properly displayed. The problem with our conventional Sea King is all of what we call, it's a steam-driven cockpit. All of the dials and knobs and everything are just, you know, they're all standalone systems. Whether it's the altimeter or the VSI, all of the buttons and knobs and all the information from the two engines, whether it be oil pressure, temperatures, everything, it's got its own little gauge. In a modern system, all those things communicate to a CRT or an LCD display, and then they're all done sort of, you know, the stuff that you don't have to monitor all the time doesn't take up big space. You can put on radar and, you know, sonar and forward-looking infrared and all this information that the pilot would like to have. And then if something goes wrong with one of the temperatures, if the thing says, hey, you know, that temperature of number one is up at 750 degrees and it shouldn't be over 600, then, what, you know, red lights are going to come on and he's going to say, you know, high temp number one. But right now, all we have is gauges and dials. So we never were to the point where we could essentially put a modern cockpit together. If we were able to do that at any one point, if we had known in 1993 that we were going to fly this aircraft, you know, till 2015, we probably would have spent the money to modernize the front office. But we didn't know. Each year we thought we're going to get a new aircraft, you know, within 2 years, within 3 years, within 4 years. So we never put the big money into make it night. Well, one of the things I didn't even mention is night vision goggles. We got night vision goggles for when we went to the Gulf. And night vision goggles were overwhelming, but our cockpit was not night vision goggle compatible, if you follow what I mean. There's all sorts of lights and stuff coming out of our gauges and dials, and they blow out the light night vision goggles. So the pilots can't see out the window with all the other glare that comes. So we had night vision goggles, but we used them in the back end. So we would go hang out the back door ourselves, and we could see what's going on. But we'd have to then communicate that with the pilots. Well, obviously, you can't fly an aircraft like that. So we always wanted to get our aircraft night vision goggle compatible. And now there is a project going on where they're going to take a couple aircraft and get them night vision goggle compatible, just so our transition to the new aircraft is smoother, so people actually get experience flying on night vision goggles. But that's the problem is, and it is overwhelming. The first time you go flying with night vision goggles, you actually cannot believe how good they are. Like, you look out into what is a complete black night, and you think there's nothing out there. And then you flip the goggles down, and you just can see everything. I mean, you can see the horizon, you can see ships in the distance, you can see all, you see what's going on. And if you're especially anywhere near shore, you can see everything And you get so used to it. And then you flip them back up and you go, oh my God, there's nothing out there. It's just amazing. So
I was returning to the Persian Gulf aircraft. What was their main role when they were over there? It was anti-surface?
Yes.
After the new mission sweep?
Yes. Surface surveillance was their main role. In other words, go out there, and because you got the ships essentially offshore in the Gulf, and make sure that nobody approaches the ships. Anybody that does approach the ships, identify who they are, you know, figure out whether they're friend or foe, and keep the ships safe. So that was our main role.
And how long did it take to get these new aircraft from that original idea to switch them over to out the door and onto the on their way?
They were done the whole process took about 3 weeks till they were sailing. I was reading somewhere in somebody's historical literature about it. We didn't even have all the equipment on by the time that they departed Halifax. Like I think we had about five that were modified. We kept one behind at HOTEF, where we were still evaluating and testing. I think we did six, we sailed five, we worked with one, and then some of the things we didn't even have till they were like we flew some stuff over to the Gulf once we've got the final, like they weren't in their final configuration until they got to the Gulf, but they were ready to go out the door. And the crew's starting to learn how to use them in about 3 weeks, which is amazing when you consider we identified the requirement, we designed the installation, we bought the stuff, we installed it, and we taught them how to do it in 3 weeks. Like in normal military procurement, that is at least 3 years. At least 3 years. So we made things happen fast.
When they were in transit, did members of HOTEF go with the task force in order to keep working on the aircraft?
Yes. Yeah. I don't remember how many we sent, but I sent three. We sent three or four with the task force. The guys that were, if they were mainly on the things that were not completely ready to go. In other words, my two projects, FLIR and GPS, they were installed in all the aircraft. They were functioning in all the aircraft. Are in aircraft operating instructions, which is the how to operate the actual stuff, and then this SMG, which is how to tactically use them. All that documentation was done, the checklist was done, so I had, there was no reason for me to go. My stuff, my two projects were at work. So, I mean, mine were relatively easy. I had two, one, you know, it wasn't that hard. The guys, The hard stuff, I think the MOS was probably the most difficult. The machine gun installation was problematic to some of the others, like the goggles were easy. The radar warning receiver was easy. If I remember, that one just came out of a Chinook. We Canada still had Chinooks at the time, and our Army Chinooks had these radar warning receivers. So we just went, they were based in Ottawa at the time. And I think our Canadian Chinook fleet was about eight or something, and they had, so they just took them all. Well, you boys aren't going to war. We are. Put them in a box and sent them down here. And so we just took them. All the things all came from different places.
You're also the head of the helicopter towed array support project in 92?
Yeah, yes, I was posted to Ottawa to look after the actual project management of taking six aircraft and modifying them to support the towed array out of the back. So in other words, turn them from an active dipping helicopter to a passive aircraft that could respond and process sonobuoys, had a MAD, had GPS, had an electronic nav system. Back in the old days, our old navigation system was an analog computer nav system, very good, but I was feeding all this modern electronic data into it, so it had to be good. And we had to actually put a MAD in the back of the aircraft. So we were like, the HELTAS aircraft was like a mini Aurora. So, and I had to deliver, my job was, the contract had already been let, and I had to deliver six of these to the fleet. Like, so six aircraft went into, the prime contractor was IMP out of Halifax. Six aircraft had to get modified and then turned around, and the concept was, we were, at the time the contract was let, we wanted to have 2 years of training on how to use MAD, Sonoway processors, and a modern electronic nav system to get our crews ready for the first delivery of the NSA, which was supposed to be about 96 or so. So we were going to have a 4 year period of 92 to 96 where we were going to have this semi-modern fleet that was going to do it. So that was my job in Ottawa.
The TOTA array coming out of the back of the ship, you wanted to have passive capabilities to match well with that?
That's the understanding of the project? Because essentially, like I was describing to you before, the TOTA array could go out and detect, okay, we got a submarine that's 60 miles away, we think. Now, because of the ambiguities of a towed array, you don't know whether it's over here or over here, because it would come in with the same frequency shift. So then what you do is normally you turn the ship, and then you get two other angles, and then you think, okay, I think he's out that way, but you don't really know. So what you would do is you would launch the Heltas aircraft, and it would go out with a bag full of sonobuoys, not just the six like in our old one, but we had 36 sonobuoys. And then we could go out and we'll drop these things and we'll try and find the submarine passively. So the submarine doesn't even know we're out there. And we're just going to go out and plunk sonoboys in where we think. And that's what we were able to do. We were able to actually... I was involved at HOTEF when we took this aircraft to sea, when we were evaluating, before we let the contract for six, I actually got to go to sea and fly off towed array ships. And we got to use it against Canadian submarines, American submarines and Soviet submarines.
Who were the towed array ships roughly? Was that the CPF?
All the CPF got fitted with towed array, but they took two ships, Fraser, it had the initial towed array, the developmental model. Fraser was called the experimental model, and then Annapolis got the developmental model. So Fraser had the first one, we flew off Fraser. And then Annapolis got the developmental one, and then CANTAS came for all of the Canadian patrol frigates. So they all, 12 of them, got fitted with a towed array. But in the early days, we were trying to figure out, does this work? Can you hang a garden hose, essentially, is what it looks like, out the back of a ship and trail it behind you as you cruise and then find out where submarines are passively? Could you do that? And we proved with Fraser you could do that. Then we also proved that, yes, not only could you do it and figure out where they were, but then you could launch a helicopter and you could go find out where they were. So we were involved in that, in the first prosecutions where we'd have an American boat or Canadian boat and set up in an exercise, and we wouldn't know where they were, but then we would go launch and try and find them.
And you said a bag of sonoboys? Are they actually...
Yeah. Well, no. We had racks at that time. We only had six chutes, but we, as part of my project, I had to put sonoboy racks in the Heltas aircraft.
And that replaced the dipping sonar?
That replaced the dipping sonar. Actually, sonoboy rack sat right where the dipping sonar reeling machine would have been. So, yeah, we had no dipping sonar.
These became the 124Bs, right?
Correct.
Did the Gulf birds have their own designation?
Initially, when we first built the six of them, because Heltas contract had been let by 1990, so we knew we were going to have the 124B. It's funny you ask that, because at HOTEF we decided, okay, this is now a completely different configuration of aircraft. So when we started building the checklists, we called them the 124C. It's a CH-124C. And we did that for about 6 weeks while we were getting the aircraft ready to go and while they sailed over. And then the great man in Ottawa said, no, you can't, because to actually create a new variant of aircraft takes a whole bunch of official E's. And you guys never actually did that. You guys just all jumped in the room and created this aircraft. Like this, there's no paperwork done. And so you don't actually have a new aircraft. This 124C, no, it can't be. So for about 6 weeks, we did call it the 124C. The early checklist that I made up, we called it, because I was on one of my jobs overnight, because we were all day doing these projects. And then in the evening, we would build the checklist so that the next day, when the guys went out to fly, they would have what we caught that was the best guess out of checklist. And we took what we did. We had Macintosh computers and stuff, and we took the actual 124B proposed checklist, because we had it at HOTEF, and we just changed the B to a C, and then we created this new checklist for what we thought was a new aircraft. So the answer to your question is, we thought it was a 124C. It never was, though. Even though to this day, we still send that variant of aircraft when we go to do service surveillance, with a few little changes now, but it's still called a CH-124 Alpha, what we call Golf model. You know, it's but we never were allowed to call it the Charlie.
You were involved with MARPAC when at the start of Operation Apollo.
Yes.
How many helicopters we send to support the mission in Afghanistan?
When I was, it was Operation Apollo was essentially the support in the Gulf post 9/11, and I was CO-443 at the time. When we sent the initial detachment. So like the first detachment to sail for the Gulf was Vancouver DET. And over the period that I was CO, I think I sent 4 DETs to the Gulf. We had 4 detachments at 443 Squadron at the time, and all 4 detachments went rotated through the Gulf with Op Apollo. And essentially, we sent the Gulf modernized birds, and by that time we were much more sophisticated at how we did the modification. I mean, you know, it had been 10 years, so we really had learned, because over the period of time, every few years, couple of years, we'd sent a detachment to the Gulf. But by when Op Apollo happened, September 11th happened, I think we sailed Vancouver DET in October. I don't exactly know when in October, but kind of mid-October. So It took that from the time that things responded, you know, and Canada came up with the role. Our initial role was in the Gulf, like from a maritime point of view. You know, our army was getting ready for Afghanistan, and our Navy was supporting the U.S. within the Gulf. But and then Op Apollo became quite distinct for the Americans. Then decided to go into Iraq and did Operation Enduring Freedom, which we did not participate in. So we continued to participate with Op Apollo, which was more presence in the region, but not in direct support of the American involvement in Iraq.
And they were Gulf birds that were sent over?
Yes, we sent Gulf birds. They were all modernized, or, you know, they were the modern variant of the Gulf bird, yeah. But
and so they were fulfilling the same anti-surface role?
Yes.
What are some of the other operations that Sea King took part in during your time at MARPAC?
Well, because I wasn't actually at MARPAC at that time. I was still at 443. And then I did 2 years there, and then I went down to MARPAC, and I was in as the, because we were actually a detachment of the Air Force living in the MARPAC building. So we didn't actually, our job was to provide air resources to the commander of MARPAC. And so I went down there as a Lieutenant Colonel, Director of Operations. And in that period, just when I took over 443, our guys had just come back from Timor. Op Toucan was the name of that one. So they had just come back from there. And then we did Op Apollo the whole period of time I was there. And then when I went down to my job within MARPAC, there was another name of an operation, and it escapes me right now, but we supported the anti-piracy off the Somalia and off the Gulf there. We sent Winnipeg to do that with a debt. But I can't remember the name. There was a name for that specific operation.
It's still ongoing, isn't it?
It's yes. Yeah.
We still have I believe it's 1 Heller debt that way?
Usually, yes. Yeah. Yeah, it all depends. I mean, it all depends. For a while, those guys were, you know, doing the Libya thing. Vancouver did the Libya thing, and I believe Charlottetown took over from Vancouver. And I think, I'm not positive now. I think they're over in that region doing anti-piracy.
What are your thoughts on the cycle, on the 148?
Well, that's a very it's a very good question. The unfortunate thing for us with the cycle and the CH-148, the military version of the S-92, is that we are in there by ourselves from the military variant of it. we had very much counted on other militaries selecting it as a shipborne aircraft, and they did not. We had counted on the American government selecting it for the presidential bird, and they selected the H-101, which they named the US-101. So we didn't even have that. We thought for sure the Americans will choose it to fly their head of state, and they didn't. And Sikorsky was unable to sell it to the U.S. Navy because the U.S. Navy was so far into their Seahawk program that they didn't want to change. Of course, the Brits and Italians were into the H-101. And then the NH-90, which is the NATO helicopter, took sort of all the European countries. So we're in there a little bit as an orphan. And we thought at least they're going to learn lots of lessons from the civilian variant of the S-92, but the sales on that have been very low. And then there was the crash off Newfoundland with the gearbox, and we were always very leery about the gearbox on this because Sikorsky. And I don't know the details on this, so I shouldn't really speculate, but I know that there were issues about whether or not they could run 30 minutes dry with no lubrication. And the history of Sikorsky gearboxes are that when they start to fail, they fail. And like anyone that's flown a Sea King or a Sikorsky heavy helicopter knows that if you have gearbox problems, you get in the hover and you get out of the aircraft because it's not going to end well. Yet they had told Cougar that they could fly 30 minutes with a dry transmission. And we all know what happened to Cougar Flight 491, of which the co-pilot was one of the pilots that flew for me at 443 Squadron, so a bit close to home. But essentially, the S-92 civilian variant that has not progressed as far as we had hoped it would. And we're in there all alone on Sikorsky's first heavy helicopter fly-by-wire. And the first three prototypes they built were not fly-by-wire. They were...
What's fly-by-wire?
Okay, fly-by-wire is like what an Airbus is, which is the controls are not actually hooked to physical. Like if in a Sea King, when you pull a stick back, there's a wire, like a clothesline wire that goes back and it pulls the tail rotor and goes from right to that. We jokingly call that fly-by-wire, but it's like, it's all pulleys and levers and all that. Modern aircraft are what we call fly-by-wire. In other words, your control stick is more like a joystick for a video game. And it says, okay, this guy just moved the stick forward, therefore, computers do this, and okay, tail rotor move this way. Sikorsky had made some small helicopters fly-by-wire, but they never made a large helicopter fly-by-wire. And as they bid our contract, they knew that they had to go fly-by-wire because fly-by-wire saves a lot of weight. And this aircraft was already overweight. So they said, it's got to be fly-by-wire. But their first three prototypes, because they're not putting a lot of mission gear on, they said, well, we'll just build them the old way. We always know how to build them. And then once we learn everything else about the aircraft, then we'll put in the fly-by-wire. But the fly-by-wire has been really problematic. Now, I don't know all the details. All I know is something as simple as pilot sitting beside co-pilot doing a deck landing. The first few times, the co-pilot, he follows the pilot through on the controls because all the controls are all wired together. Okay, so he pushes forward, pulls back, stick up, stick down. Fly-by-wire doesn't work that way. Like, one guy has control. The other guy's joystick is like, if one guy pushes forward, the other guy pushes back, well, one guy's got control of the aircraft. So he can't follow a guy through. So these are really unknown things for us in our community because, like, well, that's how we learn. That's how and the pilot at any time could take control. Now there has to be an electronic taking of control. So we don't even know how this is going to work over a ship at night, in a horrible condition in a storm. It's all unknown. But anyway, the project, as you would know from reading the newspaper, has been fraught with delays. And essentially, because this is my personal opinion, is because Sikorsky didn't sell it to anybody else, we are low on the priority list as to where the corporate funds are going to come from. So they have missed almost every deadline that they've had since the contract has been signed. yet the government of Canada is really in a difficult position, because if you enforce all the penalties, Sikorsky's level will just walk away from it. And we're not, you know, we're 3-4 years down the stream. If they walk away, then we got big problems. So I really don't know. I have not been involved with the procurement. I have not been involved with the test and evaluation. There are lots of really good things about the aircraft. It's very capable. It's going to have a great mission suite in it. It's got two good engines on it. It should be a good aircraft. Sikorsky's a very good manufacturer, but it's just, we're in a bit of a difficult position being the only military customer for it.
Looking back, what was it about the Seaking that made it so versatile and long-lasting?
That's a good question. The aircraft is, when you think about the fact that what we flew was designed in the late 50s, basically from 55 to 59. What we bought, starting, we took delivery in 63 to, I don't know, 65, 66. And then, so the aircraft that I started flying was virtually unchanged. I mean, we had a few different modifications, but it was virtually unchanged. The sophistication of our ability to, what's called a coupler, which allows us to go in the dip. I don't know if John Orr would explain that to you. Yeah, he probably did. To do that in 00 conditions, like if we're out there at night, overcast, can't see anything, yet we can put ourselves in the dip, feel quite comfortable, lower our sonar, you know, chase submarines around in the middle of the night, not seeing anything. When you think of the sophistication of all those analog computer circuits that were doing that, and all, when you look at the electrical system of a Seaking, it is so sophisticated. For if you lose this, if this happens, you know, switches are made automatically. Like, it's very, very safe aircraft. The technology and the brains that went into the design of it in that period in the 50s is just amazing. A lot of the stuff that we would ask for, and I remember when we were dealing with EH Industries, which is a consortium of Augusta and Westland who are going to build, there were several things that we were asking for that were in our 1950s Seaking that were going to be difficult for Augusta and Westland to build into the EH-101, and yet Sikorsky had it in the, you know, in our original Seaking design. So I think the aircraft was very well planned. The transmission was very good. The way the drivetrain works and the tail rotor works is, you know, like, for example, I mean, I don't know, we had tail rotor buzz on one aircraft that crashed, which is where tail rotor stop doing what it's supposed to do. But, I mean, all the time we've been flying the Seaking, I think we only had one tail rotor problem. If you look at other aircraft manufacturers, whether they be Bell or Robinson or Hillier or Augusta or Westland, that tail rotor failure and problems is quite common in a helicopter. Yet our aircraft was really well designed in that way. And it's a very stable aircraft when you're in unstable water and air conditions, and it's an amazingly reliable aircraft. The mission systems are the things that we have had problems with, all these old mission systems, but the actual airframe, engines, transmission, tail rotor, and frame, it was really well built, really well designed.
Looking back at your career, what makes you the most proud?
I was thinking about that after I looked at that question. I think the most satisfying thing for me were probably my two flying command tours. I think the tour at HOTEF, I always thought was going to be the best tour that I ever had, when they made me the commanding officer and they said, okay, these are your guys and this is your mission and go. Now we had about 20 people in the unit. And actually, what I realized at that time is my role as a technician, a person, you know, that with a master's degree that kind of knew all this technology and stuff, was very secondary to my job then was to develop all these young guys and give them the skills and attributes so that we can move on as a community, and we can get the best equipment, and also that they can be the future leaders of the community. And I look at one of my young guys that got posted in same time I did, who's Ian Lightbody. He's now the Colonel Wing Commander of 12 Wing, like in charge of the whole Sea King operation. And he was one of the guys that I developed, you know, and gave him projects and, you know, counseling and stuff like that. And it's just, that was probably the most rewarding up to that point in the career. And then, of course, I got selected to Command 443 Squadron out here, which was obviously an idyllic location away from the main Shearwater base. So that's kind of neat, because then you do run your own show. But again, order of magnitude different, in that I had between 200 and 240 people responsible for a global deployed squadron. And yet, my focus was, how do I take all these youngsters and get them ready for all the other things that they're going to do in their military career? So that was, again, you think, people always ask you about what you do in the aircraft. And what you do in the aircraft when you're running a squadron becomes completely secondary to dealing with all of their personal issues. And because in a Sea King squadron, unlike almost ever anywhere else in the Air Force, we send people away to sea for long periods of time. So you have to deal with family issues and personal issues, and you have to decide who on that squadron you are going to give your command positions to, and who you're going to make your detachment commanders. And the decisions that you make affect that person for their whole career. Because if you give them command of a detachment at a very early time, for example, then they get a chance to blossom and bloom far above somebody else. So it's a really difficult decision as a CO to decide which guys are you going to run with. Like, you got to decide which guys can win the race given the right opportunities, and then you run with them and just hope you make the right decision. But I mean, I guess the one of the things that I will remember all very much from my command tour was kind of the transition that we went through from being an old boys club, you know, very tough, and you never talked about your personal issues and everything. You know, by the time 2000 rolled around, it was quite different. I mean, we had a high number of females on squadron, and I remember getting visited by the people from DCIEM, who were the ones that were evaluating the effectiveness and issues to do with women in operational military squadrons. And one of the women said to me, she was a major and she was doing this research paper, and I said, why'd you choose to come to my squadron? And she said to me, she said, because we got all this feedback from people, and your female pilots are the happiest pilots in the Canadian Forces. In other words, you're giving them responsibility earlier and younger, and they're not feeling any discrimination for being female, and that's why we're here. I had four pilots at that time who were all progressing through, you know, essentially, a lot of my young female pilots were more mature than some of my male pilots at that same point in the early 20s. And I was absolutely gender blind. I mean, I gave the job to the best person. I didn't care whether they were male or female. But it was interesting. That's what she told me. She said a lot of that falls out of the leadership culture of the organization. And then a similar thing happened when the Canadian Forces started recognizing same-sex relationships. Yet there was a lot of people that just were terrified of the military hierarchy, because back in, you know, from time began till the 90s, we threw people out. As soon as they said they're homosexual, you're a security risk, you're gone. We threw them out. Then in the late 90s, we started saying, we recognize same-sex marriages, but we didn't really say that this is okay. We just said, well, it's legally, we've been told we got to do it. So during my command, I had five people on my squadron come out of the closet. And one of the things, and I was talking to my administration officer at the time, and we were talking about this whole thing about, you know, what is it about our squadron where these guys are coming out of the closet? Like, you know, people were saying, well, has it something to do with the community or whatever? And when I talked to the people that did, they said they very much felt the leadership culture on our squadron was welcoming and accepting of it. So why live a lie? Why not just accept reality and do it? So those kinds of things, whether it be the females feeling happy, whether, you know, the same sex couples coming out, they felt that the leadership culture at the squadron was one that was, you know, accepting of them regardless of what they were like. And I think those are the kinds of things that, as a, in my military career, to be able to have that kind of relationship with my troops, and that the feeling that, hey, listen, everything's going to be okay, and I'm interested in developing you regardless of, you know, gender, sexual preference, or whatever. My goal is to make you a better Canadian Forces person. And I think that was probably the most rewarding part.
That's excellent. This concludes our interview with Colonel John McManus. We're going to sign the interview release form.
Yep, we can do that. So interviewee, that's me.
That is you.
Okay, it's 15th of March. There you go.
And the name. Colonel McManus, we both signed the sheet.
Okay.
Thank you very much.